Thank you, Vaughn, for taking us around the world in less than 2 minutes. I love when she does that. Lagos, welcome back to Hard Facts. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. And here we are on today's Big Hard Fact, discussing the floods. How have the floods impacted public health? That's my big question on the show today. So the flood waters are receding, hopefully. We're taking stock of the damage and the destruction that they've left in their wake. Our Big Hard Fact today is that UNICEF says the floods have killed 600 people and displaced 1.3 million others. UNICEF says the floods have killed 600 people and displaced 1.3 million others. The danger isn't over. We have to worry about the health conditions for those displaced people in camps, in other high occupancy places. We also have to worry about waterborne diseases in all the places that were impacted by the floods. So on the first half of today's show, let's talk about what needs to be done to address the public health concerns. And I've got a public health expert, a public health physician, an environmental advocate on the show with me today, Dr. Abie Briggs. Welcome to Hard Facts in Lagos. Dr. Abie Briggs, can you hear me? Are you there?
Can you hear me? I can hear you. I said it's my pleasure to join your show today.
Oh, okay. Great. Good to have you on the show because I wasn't hearing you before. But yes, good to have you here. Lagos also joined the conversation. We want to hear from you. What are your questions? What are your comments about the health situation in the aftermath of the flood? Women, you know our number, 01465-7190. Men, call us on 0700-993-993. 993-993. Dr. Briggs, first of all, we mentioned waterborne diseases quite a bit. What are the major waterborne diseases?
Okay, the major waterborne diseases we have around includes diarrhea, typhoid enteritis, cholera, and hepatitis. Okay. So that's one of the some of the most prevalent infectious waterborne diseases we find in situations of flood.
Okay.
Just like, you know, a flood that just ravaged parts of the country, Kogi State, Bayelsa, Rivers State, and almost major parts of the country, especially the southern part of the country. So even till now, people are yet to recover fully from the impact of the flood.
Right.
So, but in the last few months, because we visited some of the impacted communities in the course of the flood, and we saw that there had been an increase in acute water diarrhea. We've seen typhoid spiking. We saw cases of cholera, you know, not much in cholera, but even hepatitis too. You know, so those are the kind of things you see whenever there is flood, because oftentimes there is contamination of potable sources of drinking water, you know, because of the spill of the sewage, you know, gets overflown by the flood, and then they contaminate water, both surface water and groundwater. So it's very difficult to control. So people have poor access to clean and safe and potable water to drink. So of course, most of the water they have access to already contaminated. So they come down with these waterborne diseases that are most prevalent.
And you say that we are already seeing an uptick in incidences of those diseases. Is it not too early to tell?
Water is something that nobody can do without. And I've said that in the course of the flooding, the water bodies get contaminated. But people must still drink water. So, and because appropriate measures are not taken, have been issued to mitigate, prepare, and respond to the flood. So people are always taken unawares, as it were, even though they are aware, because in this index flooding we just had, NIMET, that's Nigerian Meteorological Agency, actually predicted the flood, you know, but on the part of government and even the community leaders, nothing was really done to, you know, evacuate people on time. And when it happened, to provide basic essential needs of the people so that these incidences would have been reduced in terms of the waterborne diseases. But of course, when people do not proactively take actions that will prevent these things, of course, it is not rocket science. It's a global thing. Wherever there are floodings in many parts of the world, you expect as a public health physician for there to be an increase in the incidence and prevalence of waterborne diseases.
I see. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that access to potable water is reduced as a result of the flooding. It's one of the cruel ironies of flooding, if you think about it. And then you also think about the fact that, like you mentioned, that flood water usually contains a lot of germs. So it's a case of water everywhere, but not a drop of water to drink. And it's interesting that you've mentioned that even though people were aware that this was going to happen, there wasn't any arrangement per se about ensuring that people still had access to clean water, which is why I have to ask you, how do the authorities go about making sure that people in affected areas get water for drinking and water for sanitation? You know, what would be your recommendation as a public health expert?
Firstly, you don't wait until the floods overtake the flood-prone communities before you start to respond.
Right.
You know, in the management of flood, there are four key strategies. The first is prevention. If you can, as government and agencies of government, if you can't prevent the flood, please do everything that is within your power, within your resources, to ensure that you prevent the flood from happening, ab initio. If we can prevent the flood from happening, then we'll not have a need to for government to begin to provide potable and safe drinking water for communities and individuals. Okay, but where that fails, then the second strategy comes into force, and that is preparedness. Now, most of the flooding we see these days are as a result of climate change. It's a global phenomenon.
Right.
So where we cannot prevent it, we can be prepared for the flood to ensure that when it does happen, its impact is reduced to the barest minimum. Look at the number of lives we have lost, 600. That's the ones that have been documented and reported. I believe very strongly that it could be even twice the reported figure,
number, right.
All right? But the point is, if we are prepared, preparedness means that at the point NIMET gave the warning that this year there's going to be massive flooding, communities that are prone to flooding would have been made to evacuate to higher grounds before the floods come. And that means that government should at all times ensure that once there is information about impending flooding, that good, portable, ideal IDP camps should be built, and people moved to those camps before the flood gets there, so that we can reduce the casualties. And then thirdly, the third strategy in the management of flooding is what we call response. You can't prevent it. You are prepared. In any case, it has happened. How swiftly do you respond to ensure that lives and properties are not lost to the magnitude we see each flooding season? Okay, because this is almost a yearly event, and we cannot just fold our arms as government and agencies of government and do nothing while these things happen. And afterwards, we in fact, is about, I just don't know what to say, because when I went to one of the communities, Edoha community in our local government area in River State, it was, in fact, to even assess the communities is difficult. The flood had overrun everywhere. The roads have been cut out. You know, people were moving about with canoes and all that. A lot of people got drowned. The current of the flood was so high. People that tried to drive across the East-West Road, they got swallowed up by the flood because of the current of this flood. You know, these are things that should have been prevented, all right? So what we are saying is that government knows what to do. They know that in the management of flood, you need to prevent it. Like one of the things that really exacerbated the flooding of this, in the index flooding we are talking about, was the release of the water from the Legdo Dam of the Cameroon, okay? And when this dam was to be built in the 70s, the Cameroonian government reached out to the Nigerian government for them to build a counter dam. And the Nigerian dam was to should have been in the 2.5 the size of that of the Cameroonian dam. So when the anytime Cameroon releases their dam, the excess water in their dam, Nigerian dam would swallow. In fact, 2.5 times the size of the Cameroonian dam. In which case, if they had relieved that dam had been built by the Nigerian government, you see the extent of the flood that we have been seeing, like the one we saw in 2012 and the one we are seeing in 2022, wouldn't have been to the extent they've been.
Which
that's where prevention comes in.
Which is why I am focusing specifically on the access to water, because waterborne diseases, I mean, you yourself have admitted that at the moment we're seeing rising incidents of, you know, waterborne diseases like hepatitis and typhoid and cholera, etc., etc. But, you know, in talking about prevention, etc., etc., how do the people in power, the authorities, ensure that if they've ignored the warnings, they've ignored the NIMETs, they've not done all the things they're supposed to do, the flood water, idonshele, how do they make sure that people in affected areas have access to water for drinking, water for sanitation?
Now they need to. It's a very difficult situation. I wish you had the opportunity to visit any of the flooded communities in the time of the flood. You would have seen how difficult it is. In fact, some non-governmental agencies try to send relief materials. Now, getting the relief materials to the people was difficult because of the mode of transportation. The only way you can move about is using canoes. Okay. So the only way you can have send water across is to ensure you take the water from the cities, okay, to the communities. Now, how do you transport them? There is an extent to which you can transport them by vehicles, okay? There's a point you reach, you have to come down from the vehicles and then get a canoe or a boat that will enable you carry this water to the people that need it in the flooded communities. So, and then in the flooded communities, people are already escaping from the flood. How can they stay in the flooded areas? So they are always in the higher ground. Now, rescuing them from the communities where the flood is actually happening to higher ground is also another challenge. Okay, now getting the water across. So the only way, you asked a question. You said, how is government supposed to supply water to these people?
Yes.
I said, you bring it, maybe bottled water or sachet water. You send it across through the vehicles. When you get to where the floods are rising, you stop and you get a canoe, and it's difficult because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. Okay? So that's why for something we can prevent, we should prevent rather than responding. And I know we, in this part of the world, we are used to
responding,
being reactionary.
Yes.
We always want to react.
Yes.
But for something we can prevent, if Nigeria builds a dam now, even though the floods will still come, they won't be as severe
bad
as the ones we've been seeing.
Right.
Okay, so that's the problem. That's why I public health is about prevention.
I want to go back to that point you made. I want to go back to the point you made about the communities that you visited and how ravaged they currently are. You know, I'm thinking about those IDP camps. Well, not the communities themselves, but even the IDP camps that have been created. I'm thinking about water and sanitization and hygiene or wash, you know, as you guys have coined. I'm thinking about the major challenge that it will be there. So I want you to go into a bit more detail. Tell us how poor wash in IDP camps could lead to disease outbreaks.
I was invited by a radio station in Port Harcourt, and I was discussing this, and somebody called in, and the caller said, please don't call them IDP camps. They are not IDP camps, you know. They are makeshift camps.
Are they not internally displaced?
But there are certain things that should be in an ideal IDP camp,
right,
which is not the case. Okay, people just run to higher grounds and use them school facilities. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. You can see women, men, and children mm-hmm. staying in this in a hall of school. Mm-hmm. Okay, no privacy for the women, no privacy for the men. The children are all just there. There is no water, no good sanitary conditions. Everybody just goes about, you know, beating anywhere, weeing anywhere. Of course, defecating anywhere. So all these conditions create a very good environment for infections to thrive.
Mm.
Okay, so it's no rocket science. So what we are saying is that even the so-called IDP camps are not ideal. In an ideal IDP camp, there will be sanitary, there will be place for defecation, for bathing, for cooking, and all that. Everything will be properly streamlined.
Mm.
There will be record of people, and there are women and children will be kept separately. There will be medical services, there will be electricity provision, there will be security provision, and all that. Okay, but people just resorted to self-help. Okay, so the only help that got to people were those that were offered by good-spirited individuals and non-governmental agencies.
Okay, you're saying that government presence was absent?
Nearly absent, yes.
Interesting.
Nearly absent.
Interesting. Lagos, of course, you can join the conversation. We have our own battles with flooding here as well in Lagos. And we know how terrible that can be. I wonder what your thoughts are on the conversation that I'm having with my guest today, who's a public health physician and environmental advocate, Dr. B.A. Briggs. The numbers to call are 0700-993-993-993-01465-7190. Now, you have harped on prevention. You said prevention. But you've also admitted that prevention is not something that we do very well here. So what are the practical solutions that are currently available to the government if they want to improve water, sanitation, hygiene at these makeshift camps that are not ideal?
Now, what they need to do in an emergency situation like a flood disaster mm-hmm. is to ensure that they get water tankers
okay.
from utilities, okay?
Okay,
from the water board,
okay,
get them stocked with water mm-hmm. and take them to the makeshift camps or the IDP camps,
okay,
and then of course provide buckets and all that people to just have access. At least you're sure that the waters from the water boards are properly treated and they are portable, they are clean, they are safe
right.
for consumption and for drinking, for cooking and other domestic use.
Right.
Okay, so that's what government should do. But then you ask the question, do we even have very functional water boards?
Do we?
So you see, do we? Okay, in River State, for instance, right now I can see all across Port Harcourt, they are laying pipes. And I think in the next couple of months, we're going to see water being made available from, you know, water boards and all that. So it's a work in progress.
Hmm.
But as we speak, as of today, there is no functional water board anywhere in River State. Except those provided for private individuals, of course. but when we talk about the flow, last week I was on the Treasure FM, yeah? An enduring food here in Port Harcourt. When we talk about the effects of or the impact of flood, people do not really take into cognizance the mental aspect of it.
Hmm.
And, you know, mental issues are issues that are really downplayed in this part of the world. And it's something that nearly everybody at one point in time or the other, you know, has become a victim of. And when you talk about mental illnesses, people think about madness, insanity.
Hmm.
No, it's more than that. Now, imagine people now, the flood water is receding and people are returning back to their communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people in River State are predominantly farmers. Okay?
Hmm.
They go back to their farms have been destroyed. Probably they took some money from bank
to set up those farms. Dr. Briggs, are you still there?
Fund their farm, destroy their farms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's difficult. Now they're not thinking, how am I going to go back to my business? Okay, I've lost money.
Mm.
Some of them lost their children. Like there's a woman that lost her two children he drowned. Okay.
Yeah.
So she will obviously be depressed. She will have difficulties sleeping. She will have depression, post-traumatic stress disorders, psychosis, and what have you. Okay. So what are the things that government need to do to ensure that those that have been severely affected by the flooding, in terms of the impact it had on their lives and their livelihood,
right,
can be restored so that their lives can come back as quickly as possible to normal?
Right. Right. Okay. I'm glad that you mentioned... We keep losing the connection to you. I think it's your network or maybe it's ours. But I am glad that you're talking about the mental impact, the psychological impact of this thing on the victims of the flood, or the survivors of the flood, or the people who have to deal with the aftermath of the flood, because that's something that we don't talk about as often, like you said, as we should, as seriously as we should. And I wonder if there are other health challenges that people face in these camps. We have about 1 minute before we have to take a break, but I wonder, are there other health challenges that people face in the camps where they're at as a result of the flooding, in the places where they've moved, you know, that have higher ground? What other health challenges do people face there?
Of course, the malaria infection is also on the increase, fungal infections, and malnutrition. People don't get adequate nutrition, balanced diet.
Hmm.
It's difficult. When we went with some few relief materials to some of the IDP camps,
mm-hmm,
they were rushing for the food.
Oh, that's incredibly sad to hear, but I want to...
You can imagine, people have been starving, so when they see food, they scramble for it. And of course, in situations like that, the males will always dominate, you know, because they are stronger, they are faster, you know, to grabbing more of the food and water and other relief materials than the females, you know, so it's difficult.
Dr. B.A. Briggs, I want to thank you for your time on today's show. Thank you for...
They have lots of challenges.
Thank you for giving us a crash course. Unfortunately, your network is making it difficult for us to keep talking, and I do have to take a break now. But Lagos, stick around, because I have a journalist joining me from Bayelsa to talk about, well, how Bayelsa is dealing with the after effect of the aftermath of this flood. I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. You're listening to Hard Facts on 99.3 Nigeria Info. You just heard from a public health physician and environmental advocate, Dr. B.A. Briggs, who spoke to us about the impact of the flooding on public health. Let's take this break. When we come back, we'll travel to Bayelsa. We'll speak with a journalist who lives there. He's an announcer with Radio Bayelsa, where I used to work, by the way. We'll have the conversation after the break. Don't go away.
99.3 Nigeria Info.
Your number one station for talk. Let's talk.
I'm Sandra Ezekwesili. You're listening to Hard Facts on 99.3 Nigeria Info. How is Bayelsa recovering from the flood? That's my big question on this part of the Big Hard Fact. The glory of all lands was one of the worst affected states. I think all eight local governments had some flooding, and at least six were cut off by road. And joining me now to discuss the situation in Bayelsa is controller announcer at Radio Bayelsa, Victor Binawari. Welcome to Hard Facts, Victor.
Thank you very much, Sandra. Good evening.
Good evening. What's the current situation with the flood itself? Have the waters receded everywhere?
It's difficult to say that the waters totally receded, but the major parts, like Yenagoa, the capital, major parts of Yenagoa, the water has totally receded. However, it left a lot of devastation behind, which people are still trying to recover from. We come from a part where we usually describe as Bayelsa is located below sea level, and we're not new to flood. We are riverine people. However, we experienced the worst ever flood this year. where we've never seen this type before. When it happened in 2012, we felt that that was big. But getting to 2022, 10 years later, we're seeing something totally different from what we had experienced in the past. A lot of people would credit it to climate change and so many other factors. But sometimes you'd consider the fact that the right things were not done. That's why we got to that point this time. We're not pulling out those other factors, the factors that climate change is for real, but we think some of the right things were not done.
You know, we all saw the horrifying footage from Bayelsa. We all heard the grim situation reports from Governor Doyo Diri. But you live there, you work there as a journalist. Paint us a picture of how life was for Bayelsans day to day during the flooding.
Okay, you served in Bayelsa, so you would have a better picture of what Bayelsa looks like. For those, the benefit of those that don't understand what Bayelsa, where Bayelsa is in between Delta State and River State. And there's just one major road that connects Bayelsa to these two states. It's called the East-West Road. Most of the supplies that come in to Bayelsa, especially petroleum products, are from the neighboring states and not in Bayelsa. So when the flood came, the flood cut off the East-West road, not just from one part of the road. It cut off from River State and also cut off from the other end of Delta State. So the state was an island of its own, cut out totally from Nigeria. There were no supplies coming in. So while we were battling with the flood, which initially the Minister for Humanitarian Affairs mentioned and said that we're not that hit, and that it was not all the local government areas that were affected. However, Bayelsa is just 8 local government areas and majorly riverine. And when the flood came, it submerged every local government was affected. Every local government was affected. Like, getting back to describing how it was
day to day.
We were cut out totally day to day, yeah. We were cut out totally, so we were not getting petroleum products. While we were battling with the flood situation, we were also battling with access to petrol, premium motor spirit. And the power holding company also had to switch off power because of for safety reasons.
Right, of course.
Because we were totally underwater, so there was no need for the power to be on. So now you need to get fuel to power your generating sets for you to go about your business. So it was a double tragedy for us. Not just for the fuel, your businesses, prices were, of all the farmlands were damaged. If you follow some of our farmers on Twitter, you would have noticed that a lot of them complained about losing birds, losing their crops. Everybody had to do an emergency harvest for those that were planting cassava and all the rest. So there was totally nothing to fall back to. Prices of goods went up. It was a crazy situation.
Now, the floods are receding, but like you said, when we started, the damage still remains. So how are Bayelsa people rebuilding? How is government helping the rebuilding efforts? Have they started rebuilding?
Okay, about that, when this whole thing started, the government was magnanimous enough to have provided 450 million naira as the first tranche of the support for flood victims.
Right.
As we progressed, I think the governor also still released another 450 million naira to the flood committee to ensure that people are good. There were some gaping IDP camps that were set up. Most of the primary and secondary schools were used as IDP camps, and people were able to manage. Like I said, we're riverine people, so we could find our way around the water.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that we're not affected by it.
Right.
The government have tried their own part to see how they could help people recover. I'm not a government official. You should know that. So I wouldn't hold brief for the government.
Okay.
But some private individuals went out of their way to see how they could also support some of these flood victims by providing foodstuff, providing mosquito-treated nets, and some other items that could help these persons, you know, go through this whole traumatizing state.
Yeah.
You wouldn't understand. Like, I wasn't directly affected. I was one of the lucky ones. But I had to accommodate people that were affected in my house. So
I remember, because when I was in 2012, I remember my place in Arepa at the time wasn't affected by the 2012 floods. So I had to house a lot of people as well. I saw that Oxbow Lake was converted to a camp for displaced persons. And that one hit home for me because I hung out a lot at Oxbow Lake when you and I worked together at Radio Bayelsa. Because Yenagoe is a very small town. How was it able to handle the influx of displaced persons from the rest of Bayelsa?
Okay, that was not the only IDP camp that was set up.
Yeah.
We also had another one at Igogene.
Mm-hmm.
There was one at St. Peter's Primary School, Yenagoe. And a couple of them, like I said, most of the government schools were converted to IDP camps.
Mm-hmm.
Then some private schools also, owners or proprietors of private schools also were very kind. They were kind enough to also open up their schools for people to be accommodated. So some churches also opened their facilities also to house some of these IDPs. So it was kind of distributed to almost every space that was provided for people to just find some sort of comfort for that period.
Mm-hmm.
So, like you said, it's a small state, but we were able to manage
to make it work. You know, you mentioned very briefly when we started the back and forth between your governor and the humanitarian affairs minister over relief materials, amongst other things. Did the materials finally arrive? What was the real hold up with the relief materials?
Okay, about that. It was a clear sign of not doing your homework properly before coming out to the media to tell them these XYZ things have been sent to Bayelsa State. Apart from the fact that I work with Radio Bayelsa, I also came together with some friends and we set up the Bayelsa Flood Support Group.
Okay.
The idea was we looked at it that the government might not be able to reach out to everybody.
Right.
So we were deliberate in identifying those areas that were not getting the attention of the government.
Right.
To reach them with the little things that we were able to contribute and also get from some of our friends outside the state.
Right.
And in course of doing that, we discovered that a lot of people were suffering. A lot of people were really down. Even up to this day, I'm sure some people still need some sort of psychological, work on them to make them understand that they could still rebuild their life, even after the flood. So about the materials coming to Bayelsa, as I speak, I might not be able to give you the actual answer and say, okay, we really saw those things. But some of the items came very as at 28th of October, up to 28th of October. I'm not sure I can't really get the dates, but I know there was this back and forth where the minister said that they had sent, NEMA said they had sent to Bayelsa, but Bayelsa had not even received any item. And when it finally came, it came to a particular community that shares some boundary with River State also. Mm-hmm. And the items that came were, I wouldn't like to use the word funny, because most of these persons were lacking food. Mm-hmm. They were lacking some of those basic necessities that they needed at that time. But they were sending in clothing. They were sending in, I think, beddings. I don't want to get into the details. I'm trying to even see if I could get those documents, because
which also works out, because we're out of time. I have to take a break, but we will come back to this story. The rebuilding efforts, that's a continuous one, and I want to really follow closely with how that is going. But I want to thank you for your time today. Victor Benawari is the controller announcer at Radio Bayelsa, and he's so graciously joined us on the show today. Thank you so much for your time, Victor.
Thank you for having me, Sandra.
Lagos, let's take a break. After this break, we'll bring you the news at 6 o'clock. After the news at 6, I've got a conversation coming up at 6:15. Don't miss it.